WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A lot of people have wondered whether the future of journalism belongs to blogs, the online journals that have become increasingly popular. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been trying his hand at blogging, but is having trouble getting the style right.
Over the last couple of months, I've been posting on a group called LanguageLog.org, which was launched by a couple of linguists as a place where we could sound off on the passing linguistic scene. But I don't quite have the hang of the form. The style that sounds perfectly normal in a Fresh Air feature or an op-ed piece comes off as distant and pontifical when I use it in a blog entry. Reading over my own postings, I recall what Queen Victoria once said about Gladstone. He speaks to me as if I were a public meeting. A lot of newspapers have been encouraging or even requiring their writers to start blogs. But with some notable exceptions, most journalists have the same problems with a form that I do. They do all the things you should do in a newspaper feature. They fashion engaging leads, they develop their arguments methodically, they give context and background, and they tack helpful IDs onto the names they introduce. New York Senator Charles E. Schumer, D. That makes for solid journalism, but it's not really blogging. Granted, that word can cover a lot of territory. A recent Pew Foundation study found that around 3 million Americans have tried their hands at blogging, and sometimes there seem to be almost that many variants of the form. Blogs can be news summaries, opinion columns, or collections of press releases like the official blogs of the presidential candidates. But most are daily journals posted by college students, office workers, or stay-at-home moms whose average readership is smaller than a family Christmas letter. But when people puzzle over the significance of blogs nowadays, they usually have in mind a small number of A-list sites that traffic in commentary about politics, culture, or technology. Blogs like Altercation, Instapundit, Matthew Iglesias, Talking Points, or Doc Searles. It's true that bloggers like these have occasionally come up with news scoops, but in the end, they're less about breaking stories than bending them. And their language is a kind of anti-journalese. It's informal, impertinent, and digressive, casting links in all directions. In fact, one archetypal blog entry consists entirely of a cryptic comment that's linked to another blog or news item, as in, "Oh, please," or "He's married to her." That interconnectedness is what leads enthusiasts to talk about the blogosphere, as if this were all a single vast conversation. At some point in these discussions, somebody's likely to trot out the phrase collective mind. But if there's a new public sphere assembling itself out there, you couldn't tell from the way bloggers address their readers, not as anonymous citizens the way print columnists do, but as co-conspirators who are in on the joke. Taken as a whole, in fact, the blogging world sounds a lot less like a public meeting than the lunchtime chatter in a high school cafeteria, complete with snarky comments about the kids at the tables across the room. Some people say this all started with Mickey Kaus's column in Slate, though Kaus himself cites the old San Francisco Chronicle columns of Herb Cain. And Camille Paglia says that her column in Salon.com was the first true blog, and adds that the genre has been going downhill ever since. But blogs were around on the web before Kaus or Paglia first logged in. And if you're of a mind to, you can trace their print antecedents a lot further back than Cain or Hunter S. Thompson. That informal style recalls the colloquial voice that Addison and Steele devised when they invented the periodical essay in the early 18th century, even if blogs are a long way from that style and artfulness. For that matter, those essays were written in the guise of fictive personae who could be the predecessors of pseudonymous bloggers like Wonkette, Atrios, or Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, not to mention the mysterious conservative blogger who calls himself Edward Boyd. Actually, my Language Log co-contributor Mark Liberman recalls that Plato always had Socrates open his philosophical disquisitions with a little diary entry, the way bloggers like to do. "I went down yesterday to see the festival at the Piraeus with Glaucon, the son of Aristone, and I ran into my old buddy Cephalus, and we got to talking about old age." That always happens when a successful new genre emerges. It seems to have been implicit in everything that preceded it. But in the end, this is sort of like asking whether the first SUV was a minivan, a station wagon, or an off-road vehicle. The fact is that this is a genuinely new language of public discourse, and a paradoxical one. On the one hand, blogs are clearly a more democratic form of expression than anything the world of print has produced. But in some ways, they're also more exclusionary, and not just because they only reach about 10% of the people who use the web. The high, formal style of the newspaper op-ed page may be nobody's native language, but at least it's a neutral voice that doesn't privilege the speech of any particular group or class. Whereas blog speak is basically an adaptation of the table talk of the urban middle class. It isn't a language that everybody in the cafeteria is equally adept at speaking. Not that there's anything wrong with chewing over the events of the day with the other folks at your own lunch table, but you hope that everybody in the room will keep reading the same newspapers at breakfast.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the forthcoming book, Going Nuclear.